Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Katie Galley, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio. And Katie, this is going to be a good one.
Yep, it is.
What's your favorite part of Mondays?
I really do love Mondays. There's that hashtag of thank goodness it's Friday. I like hashtag TGIM because it's Monday.
That's right. You kick off the week. You probably already had a workout at 4 in the morning, right?
I did. I coached this morning.
Coached?
Yeah.
And now you're here?
Now I'm here. And I love being here on Monday morning.
Exactly. Because we learn about interesting things from interesting people.
Always.
All right. So, and this show is no exception. First up, we got Mike Anderson, and he is with Metal Supermarkets. Welcome, Mike.
Welcome. Thank you.
Well, Mike, can you tell us a little bit about Metal Supermarkets? How are you serving folks?
Well, we are a metal distribution business. Basically, we offer a complete range of metals, ranging from, you know, what's in the news these days, aluminum and steel, as well as a variety of other metals. And kind of what makes us uniquely is that we have no minimum orders, so we cater to, you know, a wide variety of customers. We're not really in the truckload business. It's more or less just, you know, you send us a laundry list of materials that you want, and we send you back a quote with everything filled in, almost everything.
So now, what is the typical company that buys this variety of metals?
Well, they range from, UGA, for example, and Georgia Tech, some of the mechanical engineering departments there, to companies like Publix, and a wide variety of homeowners, construction companies. It's all over the map, basically.
So it's and the metals are in a wide variety of shapes and forms and sizes?
Well, we carry, for example, on sheets, you know, sheets or plates, we carry about 100 different types. That's the types of metal, ranging from stainless steel to aluminum, in a variety of thicknesses and sizes. You know, so if someone comes in, they want, let's say 20 pieces of 1/8-inch steel cut 22 inches by 62 inches, that's something that we do.
That's something you can do.
Exactly.
And then if you weren't around, how would they would have to source each thing individually?
A lot of them have, we've been doing this for 22 years in Atlanta, so we've heard a lot of people say, gee, I'm glad, you know, I found you, because they'd be going to scrap yards or surplus places, because the larger companies don't really want to deal with the general public and the small metal buyer.
Right.
They're looking for larger orders. I'm not, you know, that's just their business model, which is larger orders. So we fill that gap, if you will, because of the fact we have no minimums, and we sell a wide variety of products, so it's kind of like a one-stop shopping center, but for, I guess, small to medium orders.
Now, you mentioned that you've been in Atlanta since for 20 plus years, 22 years.
22 years.
Is it based in Atlanta, the organization?
We're on Pleasantdale Road, just at Spaghetti Junction.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very convenient. If anything's convenient in Atlanta, but you know, and we're there because of the we can get on the highway system and deliver. Right. Our trucks can deliver.
They can get on and off pretty easily.
Fairly easily.
Now, so the organization's based in Atlanta, and do you have representation elsewhere?
We're actually a franchise.
A franchise?
And the Atlanta franchise is the oldest in the U.S. The concept was originated in Toronto,
mm-hmm.
And we have about 75 locations in the U.S. right now.
So are you the franchise owner?
No, I own the Atlanta franchise.
You own the Atlanta one. Yeah. So then how did you choose this?
Well, you know, you've heard of corporate downsizing.
Yes.
I was one of those who got caught up. And it's very difficult to find a suitable position when you're a certain age.
Right.
And you're in a certain income bracket. And so I found this opportunity and developed and started the business here.
Now, was your background in metal?
No, I was in the computer industry.
In the computer industry.
Correct.
So how did this even get on your radar?
My brother-in-law.
He owns a franchise?
No, he just informed me of it. And I went up to Toronto and talked to the people and seemed like a good idea. So
you had to learn all about different metals? Like what?
There's a story about that. I tell people that I don't know whether I was brave or I'm a little stupid, but I came down to Atlanta from Philly, from Philadelphia, with two books on metal and a roadmap of Atlanta.
Oh, so you weren't even...
No, I just started the business and...
So they wanted somebody in Atlanta? Or this was a mutual...
It was an... They were just starting the franchising in the U.S. Uh-huh. And there was one, I think... I'm not sure where the first one was. It failed. So I'm the oldest one...
remaining, right.
Remaining.
And then so... But why didn't you just stay in Pennsylvania?
Well, I kind of I love the Eagles, but I found I like the Falcons now. But no, it was an opportunity in Atlanta. In other words, there was a the territory was available. Uh-huh. The weather's nice,
right?
And I needed a change anyway. So,
you came to Atlanta with a new business and a new adventure. You had never been your own boss before, is that true?
Or
you?
I had three or four other businesses prior to this career.
So, but this is the first time you chose franchising, or you had done that as well?
No.
So you had?
I had started other businesses,
right? This is someone else is telling you how to do things now. Was that hard?
There wasn't an awful lot of help. There is now. There is. Right. I'll say that yeah. they have a pretty good training program now. But at that point in time, it was basically. Just learn as you go.
Mm-hmm.
So first couple of years were a little difficult.
And then, so are you happy that you chose this franchise path?
Yes.
You've been doing it for 20 some years.
It's gotten to the point now where my people basically run the business now. This is kind of a point of pride on my part, but I hired a young ex-military guy 21 and a half years ago.
Right.
And his wife joined 20 and a half years ago.
Wow.
And she just celebrated her 20th year anniversary. And if you think about a small business, having people with you for 20 years is like an eternity.
And to pick, are they still married?
Well, yeah, oddly enough.
That's even harder to pull off, to find two people that started together for 20 years.
No, they get along great. I'm running the office, and I pointed to the warehouse / shop door. I said, see that door? Everything on the other side is your responsibility. and quite frankly, still runs that way. So she runs the customer service, he runs the production,
right,
and I run the money.
There you go. Everybody wins. So that was a good first hire. Was that, how'd you pull that off? Was it, you were looking for somebody from the military background?
I was just looking for people who wanted to work in the metal industry. It's in even back in 96 when we started, the product's heavy. Is dirty, you can get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And finding young people that want to do that is a little difficult. So when you find someone, and basically what I was able to do with those people, I had run a couple of sales forces before. So basically it was really an opportunity to train them. And they got hands-on training every day. Mm-hmm. And then as we added new people, we expanded the training. And we have a pretty competent crew right now.
Now, is your organization... do you consider yourselves manufacturers or your distributors? Or like, where are you in the supply chain?
We're primarily a distributor. As I mentioned before, we have no minimum orders. We've got, 12,000 square foot warehouse, and half of it's sheets and plates. The other half is tubes and flat bars and pipes.
But are you cutting the stuff?
Or? Yeah, we have two automatic saws for the, the pipes and tubes and flat bars. And then we have a 10-foot hydraulic shear for the sheets, which is like a giant pair of scissors, basically. Mm-hmm. So we have half the building is devoted to that, the other half. Then we also have a fab shop where we actually manufacture things.
Oh, so you do some manufacturing.
Yeah, it's basically sheet metal manufacturing.
Right.
Which is shaping, forming, welding.
In the shape that your customer desires.
Yeah, we find a lot of our customers who are buying metal, they really, they have an occasional need for something to be built, whether it be, a box or a drip pan for a refrigeration unit. And they're not sure where to go. They don't do it very often. So, and they trust us. They've been buying from us for years. So it's just a lot easier for them just to say, okay, here's a drawing, make it for us.
Right.
So we just kind of evolve into it over the years.
Right, because that wasn't the initial.
No. Right. And it's probably right now about 15% of the business. So it's not our primary focus.
It's more of a service to existing customers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then how have you seen the business evolve over the years? Is there more demand now?
You know, that's kind of hard to put a number on the demand. I mean, it's a constant. It's a constant demand. We have, you know, customers come and customers go, things change, but our business has steadily grown. We've grown every year since we started. So some years, obviously back in the 2008-09 period, we stopped growing for 2 years.
Sure.
Yeah, like 2 years straight. And the 25th month started growing again. Right. So
now your customers, once they find you, they kind of stick around for a while, or do they kind of outgrow you if they get to a certain size?
You know, it's in the metal business, where the buyers that are buying metal, they typically are either in the metal business in a big way or they're not. Mm-hmm. In other words, you're either making things out of metal where you have a large demand, or you have an occasional, your business, you know, requires occasional, like a maintenance department in a bakery, for example. They would have an ongoing need, but it's not huge. So they never outgrow us, if you will.
And then when you're working with your customers, you guys, do you work with, like, what's your smallest customer? Is it, can it be a really small shop?
Well, we have an area. As I mentioned before, we have no minimum orders.
Right. I call you and like, hey, I'm building this thing in my...
Yeah. So if you, let's just say, for example, to make a simple example, you wanted 3 feet of a 1-inch square steel tube, just for some application you had. You could walk into we have an area called the drop area, where we take all the material that's left over from production jobs, and we categorize it and segment, you know, and put it into racks, and we sell it to the general public at a, you know, published price. So they walk in, they find something that they like, put it on the scale. It's 20 pounds, it's $1 a pound, and out the door they go.
Wow.
So we have orders ranging from $5 to, you know, $15,000, $20,000.
So now, I heard about something called a drop room. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, that was what I was talking about.
That's what that is.
Yeah, the parts, the material. Like I said, I'll start again. You know, the tubes, for example, come in 20-foot lengths. So if you bought 5 feet, we'd have 15 feet of that left.
Right,
over.
So that would just be in this room.
Right.
And then now if I came in and I only wanted 12, you would cut it for me?
Correct.
And then I just pay for whatever the weight of...
Yeah, we have a few rules on that, but I mean, essentially, yes.
Right. And so then that means your customer can be an individual person. They can just call you
totally,
up.
Totally.
So what percentage of your business is that?
Well, you know, I really haven't analyzed that part of it, because it's basically, I will tell you this, the drop room never fills up. So it's a constant turnover of material.
Because once people find out about this.
Yeah, they come back, and we have people, maintenance guys, who don't want to go through the process. They need something done now.
Right.
So they walk in there, and they're looking at, and it's all segmented by, you know, by types of material. And then they pull down two or three or four pieces and say, this will work. And out the door they go, and they're back on the job fixing, you know, the issue without having to go to purchasing, and they just use a credit card, and within 10 minutes they're
out the door.
They're out the door and you know, back in business. So that really fills, I mean, it's a small part of the business because the orders are small.
Right.
So it takes a lot of small, you know, a lot of $20 orders to make $1,000, for example.
But it's a great service for your existing client, because a lot of the people that are in that business.
Well, it's if you think about it, it's kind of win-win.
Right, and you're using all the materials. Yeah, like
and we never throw anything in the dumpster. Right. So it's just, some of the stuff we have to, we'll take over to the recycling place if it's too bulky and big, you know. But that's a small part of it.
So now at the job, the person who's working with you, who is what's the title of the person that, kind of, you're working with most often?
Well, I mean, the purchasing manager, maintenance manager, buyers. I mean, just anyone who's has that responsibility in a given business to, you know, procure the material. I mean, it varies.
Right. And then the kind of the beauty of working with you guys are your flexibility and there's no minimum orders and the ease of doing business with you.
Yeah. the whole business is based on customer service. That's the bedrock of what we do. So we are sensitive to what the customers need. We'll help them with their project. If they're not sure how to do it, we'll give them, you know, advice in terms of, multiple ways to perhaps do it. The minimum order is basically just to take away any resistance. In other words, you have a $100 minimum order, you're going to lose a certain number of people who don't want to spend $100. It also defeats the drop room concept.
Right.
Okay, so the laundry list is really important because I call it a laundry list. You could call up and say, okay, I need 12 items, 6 of them are tubes, 3 of them are sheets, I need some square bar, and I need this deck plate built, or, you know, like a deck post or whatever. We never say no. Okay, so we'll either be able to do it, or we have probably a short list of about 250 distributors that specialize in things like titanium. So, like, for example, I mentioned Georgia Tech. Occasionally they get a need for titanium, but they're not sure where to go.
Right.
We'll go get it for them. And we're pretty good at it. So that's another aspect of it.
Right. That's why you're covering all metals.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. So what happens is a lot of the distributors, the larger ones, I mean, they're in the tube business or they're in the sheet business, and they focus on one type. Not all of them, but a lot of them do. Whereas we cover the whole, you know, we have a little bit of a lot of things.
That's the supermarket part of your name, right?
Well, it's to convey it's kind of a goofy. But the thing about metal supermarkets, it's two words that don't go together, right? So once you hear it, you think, gee, that's a goofy name, but you don't forget it,
right?
So
and it kind of, for me, it paints the picture of that you have everything.
Correct. Yeah, and we hope we do, but sometimes, right. Yeah, most of the time, we can satisfy our customers.
And if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to learn more about your operation? Is there a website?
Yeah, www.metalsupermarkets, one word, metalsupermarkets.com.
Well, good stuff. Thank you so much for sharing your story, Mike.
My pleasure.
All right, next up, we got Stan Everett. And Stan, you are with Salus O'Brien. Did I say that right?
That is correct.
Can you tell us how you're serving folks?
Absolutely. We are a design and engineering company, mm-hmm. Primarily in the Atlanta office. We're one of 17 offices around the country. We joined the Salus O'Brien family about 3 years ago. I had a previous firm here for 27 years before that. What we provide is engineering services and that's designing anything that's in a building that has a function. We don't design the building itself typically, but we do design all the systems within a building, lighting, power, heating and air conditioning, plumbing, fire protection, voice and data communication systems. So if it has a function in a building, we design that.
And is that typically how it works? When someone's developing a building, they would just have one-stop shopping and then your firm would handle all the stuff that goes inside?
That's often how it works. Sometimes it's divided mm-hmm. between multiple engineering firms. But many of our projects, we do it all. It would come from a developer. It could come from an architect. It could come from a contractor. We do some design build work where we're part of the team that is not only designing but also building the project.
So if you need any metal, I got a guy.
Yeah, that's right. I'm writing his name down right now. I've got his name written down. And we work with university systems. We work with K-12 school systems, work with hospitals, just about anybody, any type of building. We work in the industrial sector, manufacturing firms, large commercial laundries to people that make all kinds of products where they have a need for process cooling or even the process itself. We have a group that will design material handling systems in a manufacturing facility.
So now when you're working with this wide variety of clients, how do you kind of stay up to date on what is the latest and greatest way of doing one type of specific thing that they're going to need?
Well, we have over 500 employees in our firm nationwide. And in that 500, there's an expert on just about everything.
Now, you're here in Atlanta?
Yes.
So now, does Atlanta have a specialty?
Not a true specialty, but we more or less focus on the commercial sector and institutional sector, which would be retail, office buildings, multifamily residential high-rise, mixed-use buildings, and then K-12 and university. We do some work at University of Georgia and Georgia Tech and Kennesaw and some of those, and then some of the school systems around too.
So now, how did the business begin?
Myself and Pete Hudson started the business in 1989, just the two of us. And we would go out during the day and try to find clients and projects. And at night, we would sit and do the engineering.
And then it's just grown organically over the years?
It grew organically over the years. And then, as I said, 3 years ago, we joined Solis O'Brien and became their Southeast regional office.
Was that a hard decision?
It was a pretty difficult decision. I'm getting close to retirement, and I wanted to have a transition that would work for all of my
folks, right.
For the firm. We were in a transition, an ownership transition process already, and it was working very well. I've surrounded myself with some great people. I've always believed in hiring people smarter than myself.
That's a good plan.
And that has worked out very well. It's been years since I've had to worry about anything in the business. I knew there were people there that could take it if anything ever happened to me. So I never had to worry about that. But we wanted the opportunity to be more national. Mm-hmm. And that gives us much more opportunity to get work for large national clients, international clients. And
that have multiple kind of units around, so you can serve all of them instead of them having to find a new person in each market.
That's exactly right. So that's where we're growing the most right now in this region is with national clients, because we have offices around the country that can cover.
Right. So one person needs. Sells it in one market, and now the whole company benefits.
Exactly.
And so you're seeing that actually occur.
Absolutely.
Now, let's talk a little bit about that kind of the exit for you, where you were thinking, how am I going to exit in a way that kind of protects my people, right? That was a big concern of yours?
Exactly.
And what were some of the choices you were pondering?
Well, we were already, as I said, in an ownership transition phase where they were buying me out over time.
So an individual
other leaders?
So some of the leaders were going to buy you out over time.
That's right.
And did you ever consider, like, I'm going to give it to the whole company, like an employee-owned situation?
We looked at an ESOP.
Right.
But we were only about 35 or 40 people, and we were a little small. The cost was pretty high. And in fact, since you bring that up, Solis O'Brien, about a year and a half ago, we became an ESOP.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So then you got to get your cake and eat it too, right?
It's been fabulous.
That's an ideal situation, I would think, for you.
It sure is. And all of the people that worked with me are still there. Nobody's been fired or left or anything. The transition's been really, really wonderful.
That's a wonderful story into itself. I mean, you're seeing so many horror stories in other industries where somebody comes in, buys something, and then just guts the company and then kind of leaves a shell.
Yeah, exactly. That was the big selling point for becoming part of Solis O'Brien, was that they weren't looking for fixer-uppers. They weren't looking for people in trouble. And as we acquire other firms now, we do the same thing. We look for high-performing companies that have a culture that's very much like our culture. Mm-hmm. And that makes the transition work so much better. And when you find someone who's performing well and has good leadership in place, then it becomes an easy transition. And that's the way it was here.
Now, what would you say for somebody who's thinking about working with an engineering group like yours? Why would they pick Solis O'Brien over somebody else? What are your key differentiators?
A couple of key differentiators are ingenuity is one. We try not to do things in a cookie cutter fashion. We try to think outside the box, to use the old cliche,
right?
And come up with a unique solution for every building. Every building's different. whether it's in a different location or has different environmental needs indoors or in a different environment outdoors. And we try to fit the design to those needs specifically for that building and for that client. No two clients are the same. So that ingenuity, and then our focus on customer service, our client relationships. We don't want to do one job for a client. We want to do such a great job for them that they want to come back and use us again.
Can you share a story maybe where you worked with somebody and they had some ideas and together you came up with maybe a better idea than what was originally envisioned?
Oh, absolutely. We do it all the time. I mentioned earlier that we have some of our clients are contractors where we actually will acquire a job together and we'll design it and they'll build it. And we get feedback from them all the time on our designs. That's a great design, but if you do this, it's easier to construct. They're the constructability experts and we're the engineering experts, and that marriage works very, very well.
So that way the client gets the benefit of both of your kind of superpowers.
Absolutely.
And then they get maybe something better than what they envision.
Absolutely. And we also work when we don't work on the same or in the same relationship with a contractor. Any job we work on with an owner may have a separate contractor, but we see ourselves as team players and the contractor's part of the team, and we work together with that contractor. Some engineering firms have adversarial relationships because...
Where it's like, you stay in your lane, I'm going to stay in my lane.
Exactly.
You know, we'll never talk to each other.
That's exactly right. And we like to get the team working together.
Like collaboratively.
Exactly.
But that's a philosophical thing when it was just your firm, or is that a Salas O'Brien philosophy as well?
It's always been that way.
Mm-hmm. So this level of collaboration is an important kind of part of your secret sauce.
Absolutely.
Because so you'll pass on jobs if they say, look, this is how it's going to be. This is, it's our way or the highway, and you guys just do what we say.
We have been known to do that. if we're not in agreement with the way somebody wants to do it,
right,
and we think that they're headed for a disaster, we really don't want to be part of that.
Right. So that's probably helped you get more business by staying true to that kind of philosophy.
Absolutely.
And you create work you're proud of.
Absolutely.
So now for you, what's the most rewarding part of the job? You've been doing this for a while. It sounds like, the end may not be near, but maybe you can see where the end is. Legacy you're leaving, you're pretty happy with?
I hope to work a few more years, but if my health holds up, which so far I've been lucky. I would say the most rewarding part for me is seeing a project built on the one hand that we've been a part of. The other part is to seeing people develop. I love mentoring younger people in the engineering business. It's really rewarding for me to see someone else develop and see them improve and establish their place in the business.
Now, is the industry still as male dominated as it was when you were starting out, or are you seeing more diversity nowadays?
More diversity. It's still male dominated. There's no question, but there's a lot more diversity. I think Georgia Tech last year, their entering freshman class was 40% female.
Wow. So that was for a big shift, right?
Big shift. Mm-hmm. There were 25 women the quarter I started Georgia
25
Tech.
25 women, not 25%.
25 women.
Right.
Out of about 10,000 students. So it's come a long way in the last 48 years.
Well, you need the brain power, right? There's a shortage of people that do what you do, isn't there?
There is right now. It's becoming that way. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's good to have more, people to choose from. Just from that standpoint, you need more bodies.
Absolutely.
And it's a great career.
Yes, it is. It's been a good career for me.
And what are you most looking forward to coming up?
Continuing to grow the business. We have opportunities around the country to expand our business even further. And also, because of my tenure, I get to pick some nice projects that I can stay involved in. And
you still get really the thrill of seeing it on paper than seeing it in real life?
Absolutely. And I love to do conceptual work. And so I'm able to do that and help some of my teams with the concepts and kind of guide that And I really enjoy doing that.
What was the first building that you kind of had on paper and then it actually was constructed? Do you remember?
Oh, gosh. The first one would have been back when I was a co-op at Georgia Tech, and I'm not sure I can remember that far back.
Was it a big building?
Oh, yeah.
A high rise or something like that?
I think one of the first buildings I worked on was actually a Days Inn.
Days Inn.
But you have one right down the street from you that our firm worked on in the early 90s, the UPS corporate headquarters.
Oh, just down the street.
Yeah. So that's the type of building that we might be involved
in. Right. So, and it must be, when you were younger, it must have been so amazing to see it on paper and then picture it in your head and then pull up to it at some point.
Oh, absolutely. And the scary part is some of the buildings I designed early on have been imploded.
No fault of yours.
No fault of mine.
Time for a new one to be there. Have you ever done another building in the same spot? Where you've done two buildings in the same location?
I don't recall one of those, but that's interesting. I'll look for that opportunity.
Right. That'd be pretty cool. So what do you need more of right now? How can we help you? You need more talent. You need more work. It doesn't sound like you need much more work, but it's always good to have more work.
It's always good to have more work. And especially with people that like collaborative design and construction processes.
So that's architects or contractors? Like who would fit the bill for people that would work with you?
Well, some
developers.
Some of our clients are architects. Some are developers. Some are contractors. Some are in industrial facilities. Mm-hmm. And like I said, school systems, universities, anybody that has an engineering need. For any building systems.
And then the first way to contact you is go to your website. You can kind of see some things about what's going on, some of the work you've done, and there's some information there to have a deeper conversation.
That's correct. www.salasobrien.com.
And then they can drill down to Atlanta. That's one of the locations.
Atlanta's one of the locations. We have 7 offices in California, 1 in the state of Washington, 1 in Montana.
All your favorite places, right?
That's right. Two in Texas, 2 in Louisiana, and 1 in Atlanta. So,
good stuff. So, again, that's salasobrien.com for more information. Thank you, Stan Everett, for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right. Now it's time for the headliner. You guys ready? We got Guy Powell. How are you doing, Guy? Did you learn anything there?
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you, Lee, and thank you for today and very interesting stories. So, very good.
Now, you're with Pro Relevant Marketing Solutions.
That's correct, yes.
How are you serving folks? What do you build?
Well, we don't build physical things, which is kind of cool to hear so far. We actually provide marketing consulting to major firms. So if you were a brand that advertises on TV, so like Coca-Cola or Geico or Allstate or Unilever or Dove or Olay, then we would help them to improve how they go to market so that they would spend that money a little bit better.
So now, over the years, has that become easier?
It probably has. The reason for that is we're very analytical in how we go to market. So that means that we need a lot of data. And so the data sets have become a lot better. And certainly then with online activities and marketing, that data is really, really good. So yes, we've gotten a lot better.
So now because of the influx of more data and maybe more accurate data, is that would seem like a major shift in marketing for a lot of people. Because back in the day, there was a saying, the saying that I'm wasting 50% of my ad dollars. I just don't know which 50%.
Yeah, exactly. We actually worked for a company. We did some work for a big software company based in Redmond, Washington. So you might know who it is. Mm-hmm. And we were just working on a small piece of their business. And we actually then, determined that 49% of their marketing was not working.
So 49%.
50% is right in there from John Wanamaker. Absolutely.
And then, but now that you can see so much data and have so much information, I would think that that has some traps involved as well. Just because you can measure something, some things may not be worth measuring.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I mean, just because it's measurable doesn't mean that it's meaningful. And quite often, a lot of marketers are making a lot of, not necessarily big mistakes, but certainly smaller mistakes in terms of using data that they think is the right data, when in reality, there might be something better out there.
Can you share some examples of what, like in our business, there are some metrics that we refer to as cosmetrics, where it might be something that they think looks impressive or important, but in actuality may not be doing what they think it's supposed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think about online media, for example, and you think about, you know, advertising in the digital space, and you bought some, you know, some display ads or something like that, most people are looking at the success of those display ads based on the click-through rate. So if I see an ad for Business Radio X, then, you know, I might click on it. And the click-through rates, for example, are only maybe, you know, 0.2%, 0.5%, so they're relatively small. Well, in reality, the 99.5% of the unclicked displays, impressions that get put out there are usually 2 to 3 times more valuable than what actually gets clicked on.
Right. I had a premise that it's better to create bad ads that never get clicked.
Well, I don't know about that.
Because if they're never clicked, you're getting still the awareness, they're seeing your brand, and there's value on that, and you don't have to pay for it.
Yeah, that's true. And I will admit, there is a big difference between a small business and a big brand, one that's advertising on TV. If you're advertising on TV, awareness is not really one of your challenges. There, it's more about, it is about building the brand, but not necessarily, building awareness. Usually the awareness is pretty high. So what you're trying to do if you're a big brand then, is to drive what's called purchase intent. So how can I get somebody to take that awareness and act on it and actually go off and try and buy something today?
But in those larger brands, how can they measure then that action was because, like you mentioned, the measurable part. I was just watching the NBA the finals last night, and there was an ad for a drink, you know, whatever, the replenishment drinks. How much of that is, if I buy that, is it because of the ad? How much is it because it's hot out? Like, there are so many variables. How can they measure that had any impact at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I was going to say, that's our secret sauce. But there's actually quite a few people that do this. And we just have a couple of ways to do it a little bit better, we'd like to think. And to your point, you also have to make sure that if you're going to measure the ad versus the temperature, the seasonality, you know, is it a hot out? Is that why I'm drinking beer? Or is it, that time of year when I need to get my taxes done or whatever it happens to be? So you need to make sure that when you're measuring any of the impact of any of your media, you're not only looking at those external factors, and you want to control for the temperature and control for the weather and the seasonality and what have you, but you also then need to look at the entire mix of what's being done. So it could be, I do that ad on TV during the game. During the game, I also have something going on in social or in search or in digital, and I want to make sure that all of those are working, you know, absolutely correctly to make sure that I'm getting as much as I can of it. And that is what we do. We make sure that what you spend your money on is going to give you the best return on, on your investment.
But then you can parse out like, okay, we should do more social. That was what really drove this or that.
Exactly.
You're able to do that.
Absolutely. So what we do is, we'll actually give you, we call it a ROMI factor, for lack of a better term, return on marketing investment. So what we end up doing is we look at, for every dollar you invest in television, how many dollars do you get in sales or profit? For every dollar I invest in social, how many dollars do I get in sales or profit? And so let's say that I invest a dollar in TV or $1 million, then I would be able to tell you that you got, you know, 5 million in sales. For every million you spent on social, you got 8.5 million. And so therefore I'd say, well, if that's the case, then I'd want to spend a little bit more on social, spend a little bit less on TV, and be able to then optimize that mix.
But can you say, okay, then that means we shouldn't be doing TV, or do they all work together?
Well, they all absolutely do work together, but there are there are clearly some synergies between them. So the TV definitely has a halo effect on social or on search. And, you know, so, but it's really a question of how you can balance the two. And so what we help our customers to do is to help them balance their media between the different marketing channels. And then the second piece second big thing that we help them do is to now really look forward and say, well, here is my plan for the second half of the year, for the next quarter or for the next month. And given what we think is going to happen, you know, our competitor is going to launch a new product, or we think, you know, this is the seasonality. Here is now then your optimal mix for the future, not just looking at the past, but definitely looking at what the optimized marketing mix is for the future.
So now your clients are typically larger enterprise clients?
Yeah, typically they're spending anywhere from $10 million up to maybe $100 million a year on media. We could do larger than that, but when you get over $100 million, the market gets pretty competitive for what we do. So we kind of try and stay in the 10 to 100 million range.
Now, are you mainly B2C or B2B?
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting that you asked that. We've two big clients right now that we've got are both B2B2C. So they sell and market to other companies and other folks that then market to consumers. And so you now kind of have a two-pronged attack that you need to do. You need to market properly to the first B level, and then you also have to market to the C level. And we also just finished a project which is kind of interesting, and I was talking to a friend of mine, and I said it's actually a B2C to B. B2C where you're to marketing to, and this is an online social media network, and you're marketing to consumers so that they can sell advertising to businesses. So it's kind of B2B to B2C to B as opposed to B2B to C or B2B or B2C.
Now, you've been in the kind of ROI of marketing business for a while, right? A lot of your background is in this realm.
Yeah, that's right. And I remember, I don't know, I guess it's now 18, 19 years ago, my CEO, I was VP of marketing for a software company. And he said to me, Guy, you know, why should I give you more money when you can't tell me how good that investment's going to work? And I said, you know, I said, darn, to be polite, I guess, politically correct. And I said, darn, you know, that is a good question. And so then that actually got me into it. And I started doing, you know, some pretty good measurement for the company at the time. And then it turned out to be really very valuable. I wrote a book. I've written a couple of books since then, and I've got another one coming out. And basically then really refining that capability so that an advertiser that's spending, you know, really any amount of money, but that's spending money to drive sales can tell how effective their marketing is.
So now, how do you help these companies that are their clients are these millennials who it seems don't have a lot of brand loyalty, and that they switch pretty quickly based on whatever kind of is in the wind today? Is brand as important today as it has been historically?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's certainly changed. Millennials are definitely upsetting the apple cart to traditional kind of marketing overall. And the real problem is that quite a few products want to sell to millennial males. And that segment is one of the hardest to reach. And so if I want to sell, you know, whatever it happens to be, let's say it's Axe for Men to millennial males, they're not watching as much TV, you know, they're playing games and they've turned off all of the advertising, and they're doing everything they can to avoid the actual media touches. And so that's just made it a lot more challenging. Nevertheless, though, they definitely like brands. And when we're just about to start working with a luxury brand and how to attract millennials to a luxury brand, and you would think that would be a challenge, but it turns out that there is this concept of luxury even amongst millennials that don't have money, yet they do want to spend actually that extra amount just to get that brand name, be able to wear the logo on their shirt or the logo on their belt or whatever it happens to be.
So on one hand, they're saying, hey, we're these unique people that want everything custom for us, and we're all about experiences. But the bottom line is they still want some logo on their shirt.
They that seems still a want a logo on their
sounds
shirt.
Sounds incongruent.
Yeah, exactly. Well, whoever said we were logical.
So you find that not always the human behavior isn't as logical as people think their decision-making is.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, there's always incongruities. And actually, it's kind of funny. We were doing a project here in Georgia, and they're targeting millennials as well, and millennial women as opposed to men. And one of the things that came out was that print magazines were actually the most effective investment for them. And they just couldn't believe it. And yet what happened is that, you know, for millennials, especially the slightly older ones, the more, not the ones coming right out of college, but the ones that have been out in the workforce and thinking about getting married or are married or have kids, they, millennial females are actually reading a lot of magazines.
Actually paper magazines.
Paper magazines.
So they're going, where are they even getting these magazines?
Well, in that case, it was because of the topic, it was an insurance product. But because of the topic, they were reading magazines like American Family, American, I can't remember what they are, the parenting magazines.
And, so they're going like in the grocery store and they're saying, oh, let me pick up this parenting magazine? Or
well, no, I think they were more subscribed. I mean, most of the time, you're not really looking for that. You're looking for the subscriptions.
So then they subscribe to parenting magazine for a period of time.
Yep. Yeah,
and then they actually—I mean, it's just hard for me to picture them touching paper.
Yeah, go figure.
On purpose.
I know. Go figure.
And paying to do it, and then and actually acting on an ad.
Yeah,
because that's another thing that people think that advertising doesn't work on them.
Well, but you know, one of the things though you have to be careful of is that we are inundated with a lot of different messages coming from a lot of different sources. So if I, you know, see a message on TV or on a billboard as I'm driving to work or in a magazine, it's the combination of all of those. So it may not necessarily be that I read the magazine and I act right there, but all of those things add up. And that's what most people get wrong, is all of those messages add up, when, especially when you're a big brand, they all add up to at some point leading to an action.
So ubiquity is important.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's something that advertisers neglect sometimes, that they think it's the one channel is the way to go and that they need to be kind of everywhere in order to really get the most bang for their buck.
Well, I think you have to separate large advertisers from small advertisers. Large advertisers understand ubiquity and understand what you need to do there. Smaller advertisers are challenged because they don't have enough money to
afford
to be able to say, okay, I want to be on TV a little bit and print a little bit and digital and social and search. And then they have to be a lot more selective, and it gets to be a lot more of a challenge for the smaller advertisers.
So what tips do you have for the small guy?
Get big.
And then call Guy Powell.
And then call Guy Powell. Yeah, exactly.
So you spend your money wisely. So now your ideal customer is who?
Definitely somebody that's advertising anywhere from, you know, 5 or 10 million up to about 100 million total. Whether they're doing a lot of that on TV or on online, it doesn't really matter. But they're spending that kind of money to be able to really understand what the needs are to be able to get that extra 5 or 10% out of their media.
Now, do you work with agencies and take on some of this analytics side for them?
We have done that. But most of the time we're working directly
with the client.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, so you have clients here in Atlanta?
At the moment, no. We have one in South Georgia, and then everybody else is generally outside the state.
And then how do they find you? Through one of your books or your website?
Well, definitely through my books. I've got a lot of business through my books, and I have a new book coming out called Marketing Machine. And then,
when's that coming out?
Well, I was hoping it was going to be this month. It's going to be close. I'm hoping it'll be, at worst case, it'll be like the first or second week in July. And then otherwise, we go to a lot of conferences, and I speak at conferences and get invited to speak. And so that also does a pretty good job for us.
And then the website?
The website is www.prorelevant.com, prorelevant.com.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Lee.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Katie Galley and all our guests here today. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.